Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, September 28th. I'm Ray Graff. Today we talk about the great outdoors. We welcome back Jeremy Hurst. Jeremy is the big game unit leader for the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. Also with us today, Carl Herzog, a senior wildlife biologist with the DEC's Wildlife Diversity Section. He's a mammal specialist and has worked mostly with bats since joining the department in 2004. Lots to talk about with both of these guys today. The number to call if you'd like to join the discussion, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email voxpop at wamc.org. Jeremy Hurst, Carl Herzog, and your outdoor questions coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We'll be discussing wildlife today on the show with Jeremy Hurst and Carl Herzog of the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. Jeremy serves as the DEC's big game unit leader in the Albany headquarters. He helps provide oversight of the white-tailed deer, black bear, and moose management programs for the state. Carl Herzog is a senior wildlife biologist, and he is with the Wildlife Diversity Section, which I really don't know what that is, but we'll talk about that. He's a mammal specialist. He has worked mostly with bats since joining the department in 2004. You got a question about the stuff you see in your backyard or in the woods out there? This is the time. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or email voxpop at wamc.org. Jeremy Hurst, welcome back. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for having us.
How was your summer?
You know, summer was great.
Yeah?
Yeah. We had good family vacations and a good opportunity to spend time outside.
Yeah, that's great. Carl Herzog, welcome to the show. You're the first timer on this program. Tell us about this wildlife diversity section.
Yeah, so the our goal is to promote and help maintain the full diversity of wildlife species for the people, the benefit of the people of New York.
Yeah, you know, the speaking of diversity, this is something that has been in the news and much talked about in my neighborhood. Tests have now confirmed an animal killed during a coyote hunt in upstate New York last year was a wolf. We have talked about wolves on this program when Jeremy has been here in the past. This was a shocker to you, Carl, or not?
I wouldn't say shocking, no. It's not the first wolf that has turned up in New York. It's expected, really, that it would happen occasionally.
Now, at one time, there were a lot of wolves in New York, right?
Presumably, yeah. I mean, we don't have great data about what that looked like, you know, early 19th century, for example. But wolves were essentially extirpated from the state. They were completely gone by 1900. In fact, you can see there's a mounted wolf that's in the Adirondack Museum that is supposedly the last wolf shot in New York. I think it was 1898 or something like that.
So they'll have to take it down now or change the sign.
They should change the sign, yes.
But, Jeremy, this doesn't necessarily mean that the wolves are coming back. This could have been one passing through?
Possibly. You know, the interesting thing with this one is that the DNA history leads it to a Great Lakes population.
Wow.
Links it with a Great Lakes wolf population versus an eastern wolf population that we would have more north of us in Quebec and Ontario.
So is that common for a wolf so far away to get lost and end up over here, or what happened?
We don't know. So, you know, one of the curiosities that comes with this is obviously we have a large animal, a large canid that gets taken in New York, and so then you question what's the history of it. Question as to whether it is a coyote or a wolf, and there's mixed genetic relationships, and Carl can give you all the details on this more so than I, but how did it get here, whether it was a lone animal walking on its own or whether it came in a vehicle, whether is there's some domestication history of this animal.
Oh,
and so there's some
does
questions.
Does that really happen?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've had, I think, in the Northeast, so New York and New England, there have been at least 10 wolves that I know of that have turned up, and probably more than half of them were former captive animals that were somehow released into the wild.
Well, why would you want to do that?
I have no idea.
Good question.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like very sensible.
No.
Now, Carl, when we were talking in the green room before the show, we had talked a little bit about the DNA testing that initially said, okay, this is a coyote, and then later another test said, nah, we think it's a wolf. Sure. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So one thing that's important to learn is that there is no actual genetic definition of what a species is. So we use genetics to give us clues as to what we're looking at, but the situation isn't always clear. And particularly when it comes to these wild members of the dog family, it can get really confusing. Wolves and domestic dogs and coyotes can all interbreed. And to some extent, that has happened in the wild. And there's numerous examples of animals that have genetic material from both wolves and coyotes together, wolves and dogs together. So it's not a simple, straightforward question to try to answer as much as you might like it to be.
I have never seen a wolf in the wild, or really I don't think anywhere else except TV. Mm-hmm. Give us a sense of the difference in size between a coyote and a wolf.
Okay. So in New York anyway, the typical coyote is probably in the 30 to 40 pound range. And similar proportions to what you would expect from a domestic dog of that same weight. The biggest ones may be just barely breaking 50 pounds.
Okay.
The wolves from the, let's talk about the Great Lakes population that we were mentioning earlier. A typical male wolf from that population might be 85 pounds. So considerably larger.
That's pretty big. All right. Yeah. Well, now, I want to talk about the tricolor bats as well, but we have an email here from Jim. By the way, the number to call here is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Jeremy Hurst and Carl Herzog are with us from the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. Simple question from Jim. Are bats returning?
That's a good question. First, I'll set the stage for the question. You know, the reason he's asking that is because we lost a significant number of bats in the past 15 years due to a disease that's generally referred to as white nose syndrome. It's a fungal disease that killed a lot of hibernating bats, and in fact, it took the formerly most common bat species in New York, which is the little brown bat, and we literally lost 90% of them. And that's on that particular species. The news is actually quite encouraging. The 90% decline happened in the first three or four years of the disease, and since then the bats have recovered apparently to a certain degree. We probably have twice as many now as we had back in 2010.
Do we know why?
Yeah, so we're actively engaged in assisting university researchers. Several different groups trying to answer that question. There's some evidence that the bats that have survived are genetically different in some ways, and now we're trying to prove, you know, how that those genetic differences are conferring some sort of better survival. It seems to be allowing them. So the primary way that the disease harmed the bats was by waking them up from hibernation more often than normal. And every time you do that, it takes energy, and they would just burn through their fat resources, and then they'd essentially starve. Or more commonly, they would just fly out of the hibernation site in the middle of winter in an apparent desperate attempt to get something to eat. Most of the little brown bats that we find today have more or less returned to their normal hibernation behaviors. They're not waking up more often than normal. They're all getting the disease still. They haven't. It's out there. But it's not affecting them nearly as much. So on that particular subject, that one species, the news is rather encouraging.
Now, we saw a news item a couple of weeks ago. U.S. officials are proposing to list the tricolored bat as endangered. It's among a dozen bat species across the nation suffering sharp declines because of the white nose syndrome. Where do you guys stand on possibly designating those bats as endangered?
Yeah. So The Fish and Wildlife Service, our federal counterparts, have decided that the status of the species deserves endangered species protection. And we have a coordinated listing provision in our regulations, so we'll list them at the state level as well, assuming that that happens. There's no doubt that the declines have been severe. In fact, I just talked about a 90% decline. So the tricolored bat in New York was never common because we're kind of on the edge of the range. You know, that's more of a southern and western species than the northeast. However, we had them, but we lost literally 98% of those. So almost completely extirpated from the state. And that's when you get start talking about those kind of numbers, then you're in endangered species territory.
Let's take a break here. We are just getting started with Jeremy Hurst and Carl Herzog from the New York DEC. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. We'll be right back. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. 800-348-2551 is the number. Ray Graff with you. Always fun to talk to Jeremy Hurst from the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. Today he brought yet another biologist. Carl Herzog from the DEC is here as well. And we're ready to take your calls. Let's hit the phones. 800-348-2551. Eve in Rexford. Eve, it's all about you.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My husband and I were talking recently about how much we like to hike in the fall, but it's always scary about the hunters because we don't know where they will be and when they start, and are bow hunters out there, et cetera. I just really would like to know more about how to be safe.
Jeremy.
Sure, Eve, that's a great question. So thanks for calling in. Yeah, so hunting seasons have begun somewhat in New York State, and there more will be coming this weekend. We have some small game hunting seasons that have already begun, and beginning on Saturday, it's the start of our bow hunting season for big game. And so in your area, we can anticipate that there'll be some folks out looking for squirrels and rabbits and deer. Squirrels and rabbits probably with a shotgun and deer with a bow. Now, of course, I can understand the concern about sharing that space with hunters. Hunters are going to be using public land. They're going to be seeking out squirrels and rabbits along the edges of fields and in the forest, and deer probably in the forest. Now, interesting, of course, they're looking for those particular animals. They're not looking for hikers walking on the trails, but they are aware of what's going on. And of course, they are tuned into where the trails are and certainly are trained in how to hunt safely. And one of the key tenets for hunters to go through their hunter training courses is to be aware of their target and what is beyond. And so they, in order to practice proper firearm safety, that's a principal factor for them all. And our records for hunter safety in New York are excellent.
So Dick Cheney's not been around?
Not okay. In New York.
Fair enough.
So we have excellent safety records. That doesn't necessarily make maybe a stat that makes you feel more comfortable knowing that there are others out there with firearms. But as it stands, hunters are extremely safe. One thing that we've done differently in New York recently is we've required all deer and bear hunters when hunting with a firearm to wear brightly colored orange clothing. That makes them more visible to each other, but also to other non-hunters.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Does it also make them more visible to the bear?
So not for deer and not really for bear either. Deer have different light sensitivities, and so they can't pick up the orange color in the same way that we do. A bear may be a little bit more aware of that, but yet even the bear, their eye design is geared more towards less bright colors, and so they would see blues a little bit more, greens more so than the bright orange. It looks more grayish.
Yeah.
But so for Eve, for yourself, just to be aware while you're hiking that there may be others in the woods, wear some bright colors yourself, make noise as you're walking, and this shouldn't be any issue for you.
Eve, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it. 800-348-2551. Jeremy Hurst and Carl Herzog from the New York State DEC with us today. And we go to Albany. Nancy, you're on.
Hi. Yeah, I have a question. I have a rural property, about 20 acres. And I noticed a couple of years ago, coyotes came right up to my yard. Like, we were actually operating the riding lawnmower at the time, so it was very noisy, and so it kind of spooked us a little bit that they would come that close to a noisy piece of equipment. And I have little grandchildren, and I worry about them being in the yard. And I just wonder, are there measures I can take to protect myself and my family? And also, if I want to walk in the woods, are there measures that I should also be taking there? I don't want to kill or trap anything if I don't have to. I surely don't. Can you make some recommendations?
Sure, Nancy. When you're out and about in the woods, you know, there's always a chance that you could encounter all sorts of wildlife. And so just being aware of your surroundings is important. I mean, hopefully that's why you're there, right? You're there to see what you can see. And watching a coyote work through the woods is actually a pretty exciting experience. And, you know, with many wild animals, there's always the chance that they could be curious and approach you. And that can feel threatening at times. The instances where coyotes or other wildlife actually approach people in a negative way are very rare. And so I want to kind of back down from some of the fear a little bit, but recognize that you also have some things at your disposal. One is you're much bigger. And so if an animal like a coyote is nearby you and is curious and looking at you, it may just be looking at you because it's not quite sure what it saw, or it may be trying to detect the odor that's floating through the air. But make yourself big. Hold your arms up over your head. Wave at it. Yell at it. Let it know that you're a human and that you don't want it there. And, you know, 99 times out of 100, that'll take care of the issue right there.
What about that one time?
That one time, then you want to fight back. But that is a rare situation that very few people.
I have a 4- and 5-year-old.
Sure. And so let's talk about at your home. And so the first thing we want to do is to change the environment that dissuades the coyote from being there. If there's any food that the coyote may have had access to, whether that's pet food that has been left out for cats or dogs, or livestock feed that's in the area, or a compost pile that the coyote may be coming in to get, or it might be that you have an abundance of meadow voles in your field. And so that's a very strong possibility if you're mowing large acreages. Those are reasons why the coyote might be there. If you're concerned about if you have a particular animal that's creating a problem, of course, we can help facilitate some response to that if that's necessary. So you can call our wildlife offices to understand best how to deal with that individual animal. But in general, coyotes aren't going to look for a reason to come close to our homes unless we give that reason to them in food of some form.
Nancy.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. Now, if you're fighting a coyote, what's your best hack?
Well, I'm pretty sure, didn't Roadrunner use a big...
we'll get a 16-ton weight and drop it off a cliff. Yes, right. That makes perfect sense. We're joined today by Jeremy Hurst and Carl Herzog of the New York State DEC, and we'll get to the email bag in a little bit. We have a number of emails, but let's continue on with the phones. We go down to Orange County. Clark is in Mount Hope. Clark, you're on.
Hey, how we doing, gentlemen?
Good.
I got a comment and a question. The question first would be, is it normal to see young deer this late in the season? That would be the question. The comment is sort of about bats. I had bats in my shutters for a while, but they were gone. And about a week ago, I saw one, but it was during the day, and it flew into the shutter. So I don't know if that's good or bad. And I'll listen up, and thank you.
All right, Clark, thanks a lot.
So I can address the bat question first. Having bats underneath your shutters is actually really common. It's almost like a perfect bat house location for them. Typically, there's the bat species you're talking about there is known as the big brown bat. It's the most common bat we have in the state. A lot of them live in and around houses. It's a hibernating bat, though, and as the weather starts getting colder, which is what we're moving into right now, they're getting ready for hibernation, and so they generally are going to leave the shutter situation when the weather's too cold, and go into some an underground situation, a cave or a mines, is the natural location for them to spend the winter. So that's coming up. Pretty soon, it's totally dependent on the weather and what the temperatures are running.
Will they, if there are no mines or caves, will they go for a sewer or something like that?
Occasionally, yes, but generally that's not common in New York because sewers and culverts are usually just too cold. Anything that goes below freezing is really unacceptable for the bats.
All right, let's get to the question, Jeremy, of I believe Clark was talking about the preponderance in his neck of the woods of young deer at this time. Is that common?
Well, preponderance may be the wrong word, but maybe a single occasion.
Okay. Oh, well, he said he saw a lot of them.
Well, so I'm assuming what you mean by this question here, Clark, and you're not longer on the phone to clarify, but of maybe a spotted fawn that looks really, really small. Fawns are generally born in late May and early June. And so this time, mid-September, late September, we're looking, if there is indeed a fawn that is quite small, 10 pounds or less, that would be, you know, relatively newborn, that's extremely rare. And so as with most things in nature, they occur in a distribution where the majority happens at one point, and then there's tails on either end, some early, some late. And so it's not uncommon, or rather unheard of, for us to learn of fawns that are born really early, say in March at times. We might hear one or two of those a year, and also some fawns that are born in August and September, one or two a year. And so in that sense, it's not unheard of, but it is very rare and uncommon. And you can understand that from a biological standpoint for the species. They're timed to breed and then give birth at a time when those fawns have enough time before the conditions change in winter so that they are able to get enough nutrition and grow so that they have enough fat and body size in order to make it through winter. A fawn that's born this late in the year is going to have a really tough time making it through winter and having enough body growth and development to be prepared for that. So it is unusual, but it is not out of the realm of possibility by any means.
We have seen very young deer recently in our neighborhood, and I have two questions for you. One, how long does it take from birth until that deer is fully grown?
Well, fully grown deer is about 5 to 6 years.
Okay.
But from birth until when it is weaned and is no longer dependent on the doe is about 10 weeks. And so if we have a fawn that's born in early June, generally by mid-September or mid-August, rather, they can be fully independent. If the mother gets harvested by hunters or killed by a car, the fawn has great, great survival chances. They're no longer dependent. And so one of the reasons that we have some of these extremes, so for instance, in New York, relatively few fawns will then breed that first year. But sometimes we have a female fawn who come the first year, or maybe physiologically may become ready for pregnancy late in the breeding season. So she may be starting to breed in January instead of in November. Mm-hmm. That way, then she's bred in January, she's going to give birth several months later as well. So that could be the consequence of a situation like this.
And the other question I have is, as we have watched some of these young deer sort of, well, first of all, our neighborhood might as well be Catskill Game Farm now. I mean, they just run amok. Every kind of critter you can think of, or most any. We see,
wolves?
No, I don't know, but I'll call you if that happens.
Please,
all right?
Do.
No, but we saw a group of three. And they were clearly very young together. And it seems, and maybe we have it wrong, that they have sort of grown up and they have stuck together. Is that common? The family unit, is there any such thing in the deer world?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and so when fawns are born, and a triplet is not out of the question either, generally we see singletons for young deer. A young doe may have only a singleton. Older does may have twins more commonly, and triplets happen occasionally. But they will stay, those fawns will stay with their doe for a full year until they're ready to be bred themselves. And so at that point, then they breed and they stay generally in the same overlapping home range, not necessarily traveling side by side, but it's not uncommon for these matriarchal or matrilineal groups to inhabit a space for multiple generations.
What if mom is gone? Something has happened to mom. Will those three stay together for the normal amount of time anyway?
They will, but probably of those three, one or two may be males. And generally, the males will disperse from where they're born. And so come fall during the prior to the breeding season, or either that or during the spring prior to the birthing season, those young males will disperse to some other area. They may travel 1 or 2 miles, or they may travel 20 miles.
Jeremy Hurst is with us, Carl Herzog as well, from the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. The number is 800-348-2551. Let's go back to the phones. Merle in Argyle. Merle, you're on.
Hi, this Moss Margile.
Yes.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Not bad. Sitting out in the rain under the apron.
Okay.
Coy dog. Now, is that a coyote or a wolf?
Coy dog.
Well, virtually every coyote in New York State, probably every coyote, has some portion of wolf DNA in its own genetic makeup. And so the research that has been done over the past years on this has really demonstrated that all of our coyotes have that wolf component to them. They're also, as Carl mentioned earlier, the potential and in some cases substantial interbreeding with dogs. And so there can be a coyote-dog hybrid as well. And that's going to be individual animal to animal to the degree that is occurring. So whether or not there's this widespread movement of these animals into New York is probably that's an interesting hypothesis, but not really anything to suspect that that's the case, but more that as animals are here, that there's a potential for some interbreeding.
All right, Merle, thanks a lot. We go now to Wilton, and Ann, you're on.
I think most of my questions have been answered. We hear a lot of howling at night, and I'm in the northern part of Wilton, and it used to be very rural because I can remember seeing hunters come out of the woods with turkeys, and I've seen deer in the area. So I guess the neighbors get out there, and we hear this howling, and we alternately use the word coyote or coy dog. I've seen two of them. The first one had a red spot on its shoulder, and it looked like it had been injured because he kept worrying it. And the one I saw yesterday, they're all skinny. They're kind of a grayish brown, no hair, very thin. And we've got a stream that runs through all our properties way back in the woods. So it's good for the wildlife. But we don't know what they really are. Coyotes coy dogs.
So I would suggest that, based on the description you just gave, those sound very much like coyotes.
Okay.
Jeremy suggested, you know, some of these animals have a small amount of wolf or dog DNA, but as a they're still functioning as a coyote, and we have no problem calling them coyote as a species name.
Okay.
So that's
now,
most
are they
likely.
The ones that...
Go ahead.
Well,
I was going to say.
Are they the ones that?
You go, Ann. You go.
Are they the ones that ate all my little bunnies that were running wild around the yard? There was only one left by midsummer, and I had four or five little ones. Every morning and evening, they'd be hopping around.
Oh, okay. Something happened with the phone. Are you still there, Ann? No.
Like
something
it.
Happened. Okay, well, we get the gist. Ann, are you still there? No.
It's very possible that the coyotes took the rabbits, the prime food source for coyotes. Yep. We've done quite a bit of work with coyotes, and there's some really interesting facts about how coyotes live in New York State. First off, you mentioned the coloration of the coyotes, and there can be quite a lot of variation in the coat coloration of coyotes, from very dark, almost melanistic, very fairly black in color, to the classic mottled gray, to very reddish and tawny colors. Some really interesting variations. But from a from an ecological standpoint, from the diet studies we've done and the GPS collaring and backtracking of where coyotes were spending their time and kill sites we visited, some coyotes become real specialists in the food sources that they seek out. You may have a group of coyotes, and some will key in on woodchucks, some will key in on rabbits, some, of course, will key in on fawns during the period when fawns are available. And so they can become very specific in the prey items. But, of course, they're generalists in their diet, and they'll eat berries and small mammals and nuts and human-supplied pet food, too. But some really interesting things there. And also with the calls that you hear from coyotes, because of the way their vocalizations work, it often sounds like there may be a dozen out there in the field behind you.
Yes.
But really, that's probably only about two animals, maybe three.
How do they do that trick?
It's just the unique way that our ears pick it up. Carl, are you
looking to
add?
Yeah, so the Jean was the name, the caller. She used the term howling, and generally that's not usually the way you refer to the sound that coyotes make.
No, I guess it's more of a barking.
Yeah, barking or yipping kind of sounds, and
yeah,
it's so repeated.
Yes.
that it often does sound like it's a lot more individuals than it really is.
All right, Ann, we have to take a break here. Before we do that, though, Carl, I should tell you that Jeremy sometimes gets annoyed with me when I ask, oh, how many moose are there or how many deer are there? And he'll say, you know, he'll say four. Right. But do you have any idea how many coyotes are around?
Well, I don't know that anyone has a very accurate idea, but they are throughout the entire state and quite abundant.
Will they head out to suburbia and chomp on rabbits in the suburban lawn?
They're absolutely in suburbia, definitely.
Because okay, I have a lot of rabbits I'd like to get rid of.
I actually participated in a coyote diet study that was run by the New York State Museum, and most of the animals we were studying were inside the city limits of Albany.
You are kidding. Let's take a break here. Carl Herzog is here and Jeremy Hurst from the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. We'll hit the email bag and then back to the phones in a moment. Vox Pop on WAMC, Ray Graff with you. The number to call is 800-348-2551. Jeremy Hurst is here and Carl Herzog from the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. Before we get to the email bag, Jeremy, you mentioned the Gotham Wolf Project, Coyote Project.
Gotham Coyote Project.
What's up with that?
Well, so the last caller asked about distribution and number, or you asked about
the
number
of
coyotes. And so we have work done in New York where we've estimated the minimum coyote population to about 30,000 in rural areas, but that doesn't include urban and suburban areas. And we certainly have coyotes in urban and suburban areas, not just in Albany, Bethlehem, but in New York City. And some of the researchers in New York City at the Natural History Museum and the City University of New York have been working on this project called the Gotham Coyote Project. And I encourage anybody to look it up online. It's a really neat project where they've been monitoring coyote movements and behavior and ecology inside the city limits of New York City.
Interesting. Now, I mean, if you are uninitiated, as I certainly am, can you tell a difference without question from a dog and a coyote? Or if you don't really know the difference, will you just say, oh, that's a big dog running around?
Yeah, it can be very difficult depending on the species of dog and the distance at which the observation is occurring. Coyotes tend to have a little bit more of a pointed snout than many dogs do. But as you know, the domestication of dogs causes all sorts of crazy variations, so it can be tricky.
All right, this is from Amy, who says, some friends and I were recently wondering, as we've seen deer antlers for sale in pet stores at ridiculous prices as chew toys for pooches, if deer lose their antlers every year and deer are everywhere, why aren't fields and forests littered with them? We hike in the woods along farm field edges. We never see antlers lying around. Why is that? And that's from Amy.
Go for it, Carl.
Yeah. So definitely, you almost answered the question yourself. The antlers are being sold as a chew toy, and the antlers that deer drop in the woods get chewed by small animals. They're going for the mineral content there, and they sometimes hang around. You know, the it'll take a while for them to completely disappear, but that's their ultimate outcome. Is they get chewed up by small rodents and other animals looking for minerals.
You know, if someone's hiking in the woods or even not in the woods and they come across a dead deer, do you call the DEC or do you just say, well, we'll let the bugs and the critters take care of that?
Some people do call, and I guess it depends on the time of year and maybe the circumstances under which they find. Right? In many cases, you might find the skeletal remains of a deer, and obviously the value of knowing that deer has died is relatively little. This time of year and late summer, early fall, we have a disease that comes into New York periodically called epizootic hemorrhagic disease that has resulted in a number of deer deaths, and often in fairly unpleasant circumstances. Deer will die next to a stream or a lake or sometimes in a pond. And we certainly want to learn about those circumstances because we're tracking the progression of that disease and the extent of it. If there's multiple animals that are dying in the same vicinity, then of course that's another indicator that there might be something going on that we want to know about.
All right, this email from, I don't know who. If these animals, wolves, dogs, coyotes, can interbreed, why haven't they evolved into a new species collectively?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think the best answer to that is saying we're watching evolution happening, you know, as we see it. I mean, it takes a long time. It's a relatively it takes a long time. It's a slow process. But the introgression of wolf DNA into the coyotes in the Northeast is an example of a change that has allowed the coyotes to engage in different behaviors. They're more successful hunting in forest situations. You know, the coyotes from the West are open land animals. They're prairie and desert kind of habitats, and so that wolf contribution actually has changed the nature of how they live and hunt, and it's resulted in them being better suited to living in the forested Northeast.
This email from John. We'll do a couple of more emails and then hit the phones again. This one from John. What tag do you use to tag a deer if you take it with a crossbow during bow season?
So during the bow season, hunters have several tags at their disposal. Usually a hunter has a bow muzzleloader either sex tag or an antlerless only tag, and maybe a deer management permit tag. And so the deer management permit, of course, is the antlerless tag that we issue that's management unit specific. Depending on the sex of the animal, whether it's a male or female, or whether it has antlers or not, that would determine whether you choose the either sex bow muzzleloader tag, or if it was an antlerless deer, you could choose the antlerless only tag or your deer management permit. But there's no specific tag that is used by crossbows exclusively.
Okay.
Depends on the season.
This one's from Penny. This is an interesting one. Moose in Lower Dutchess, Connecticut border. There have been several Facebook posts the last few days of folks who have spotted a moose on Quaker Hill in Pawling. And one was spotted in the AMC movie theater parking lot in Danbury, Connecticut yesterday. Seems to be more common than the last few years to see moose in this area. Are they just wandering out of their normal northern areas by chance, following food supplies, or are they losing their habitat due to new construction? And that's from Penny in Wingdale.
So, Penny, it's probably neither of those.
Huh.
The reality is that we have moose in northwestern Connecticut. That's not far away from Dutchess County.
Yeah.
And so it's not uncommon for moose to move across the border and into New York. We're in the middle of the moose breeding season. Actually, the tail end of it typically is earlier in September. And so the male moose are moving around looking to find a mate. And sometimes they wander in places where there aren't moose.
Like a parking lot in Danbury.
Yeah.
That's very strange. Now, we've talked about this before. I always thought, you know, moose are pretty far north. In Albany County, in Schenectady County, around here, are there moose in the woods?
Probably not in Albany and Schenectady County on a typical basis. We're on the southern extent of their range in New York. We have moose in the southern Adirondacks and Saratoga and Herkimer counties and Fulton counties on the northern edge that may come south into the Capital District area, but more commonly is towards our east. And so in the eastern part of Rensselaer County, eastern Washington County, parts of eastern Columbia County, we have a shared population with Vermont and Massachusetts on that Taconic Ridge and then into the Berkshires. And it's not uncommon for moose from that area to move down off the hills and closer in towards Troy. We had one a couple weeks ago that was sort of in the northwestern portion of Rensselaer County. It happens from time to time.
Well, let's go back to our phone lines, 800-348-2551. Carl Herzog and Jeremy Hurst of the New York State DEC are with us. And let's go to Scroon Lake. Jerry, you're on.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
I want to get back to a bat question.
Okay.
I live up here, and there's woods around my house. My house is a stone house. And the bat, I am a supporter of protecting the bat population. However, occasionally in August or September, a bat somehow will find its way into my house. Because it's a stone house, I can't close up every nook and cranny. So my question becomes, how do I get that bat that's flying around my head at night caught and put so I can put it back outside safely without endangering myself or endangering that poor critter who lost his way and is just looking for a place to sleep all winter?
Hmm.
Yeah, so that's a real good question. Not at all rare. August is probably the most common time for something like that to happen. Typically what you have
there... That's what happened a couple of weeks ago, yes.
Yep. So that's when the young bats of the year that were just born this year start flying. And like a lot of teenagers, you know, they get themselves into trouble. They don't know what they're doing. So the way to capture it inside a house is to wait until the bat lands on some surface, and then you cover over the top of it with a like a box or a piece of Tupperware or something like that. And then you can slide a piece of cardboard up between the wall and the box, and you've contained the bat. And then you can take it outside and let it go. That's the...
Well, you know, I've done that occasionally even with mice. However, they seem to find places to hide in my house, like behind a picture frame or, you know, wherever, where I'm not able to do that.
Yeah, that's so definitely, definitely an issue for sure. The best advice I could say if you've met your match and the bat has outsmarted you is there are professionals that you can bring in that'll be able to do that.
Okay.
Without killing the bat?
Yeah, generally speaking,
I don't want to kill the bat. Right. Although one time I did because he was flying around my head so bad, and I opened the window up to try to encourage him to go out. Actually, I didn't kill him. I think I knocked him out.
Ah.
And I took a broom, and I tried to shoo him out with the broom. But unfortunately, the broom hit him, and he ended up on the floor, and I put the towel over him and put him out the window that way. Whether I just knocked him out or whatever, I never saw him again, so maybe he was safe. But I don't really want to do that.
Yeah,
he
didn't press charges. That's the main thing. So thank you very much, Jerry. We appreciate that call. I mean, should Jerry be worried about rabies?
Well, see, that's a good question. Yes. And you do need to consider the potential for any bat that's in your house to possibly be rabid. Now, the percentage of bats that are actually rabid, free-flying bats that have rabies, is quite low. But it's an invariably fatal disease. You don't want to mess around with it. So the goal is to evict the bat from your house without ever having any skin-to-skin contact. And if that ever occurs, then you need to consider the potential. And at that point, you should be talking to your county health department for advice on what to do.
All right, let's go to Grafton now. And we haven't had a beaver question in a while. So this is how do you say your name? Gogtu?
Bob.
Oh, it's Bob. It says Gogtu here. So it's just Bob. I have that one down. It's all right, Andrea. These things happen.
I'm just Bob.
I'm going to call you Gogtu.
So a beaver has taken up residence under a dock that I have on basically a big pond, and my water source comes in right next to the dock. Could I get chlamydia from that? And how is the beaver going to handle the winter under a dock? I assume it's a male, but could be a female, I guess.
Well, sir, so Bob, I think I would be more concerned about Giardia.
Yeah.
But either way, what I would recommend
I'm Giardia. That's what. Did I say something?
Chlamydia is something else.
Right. Right.
No, believe me,
you want to avoid Giardia.
Yeah.
It's not pleasant.
Right.
But what I suggest is you contact our regional wildlife office in Schenectady. We can work with them to help remove the beaver from underneath the dock and get that cleaned up.
You guys are already out here. You set a couple of traps up in the pond.
Great.
To kill it. But
well, what we need to do is remove the lodge and clear out the space so that beaver doesn't try to make that the lodge space, so that it's not contaminating your water supply.
It has been doing that all summer, and it's just a matter of if it cleared out, he'll just come back. So is that likely that the Giardia? Do they all have Giardia?
That I don't know.
What is Giardia?
It's a parasite that.
It's a parasite.
Okay.
Yeah, that causes intestinal
horrible
problems.
Diarrhea.
Okay.
Yeah, horrible diarrhea.
So let's avoid that and see if we can get the beaver issue taken care of. Our regional staff can help you with that.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Bob. We appreciate it very much. And now to Stone Ridge and Jim.
Hello?
Hello. You're on.
Hello. This is Jim Blair.
Hi, Jim. Welcome.
Hi. Learned a lot about deer today.
Oh, good.
But I got one more question I don't think you addressed. When do fawns lose their spots? At
Tuesday.
What age?
What did you say, Tuesday?
They lose them on Tuesday.
Cut it out.
No, so fawns will lose their spots when they start to transition to their winter coat. And so they're born with a really light, thin coat that's spotted, obviously. But as they approach into cooler weather and as the days get shorter, that'll trigger a physiological change that they'll lose their – they'll change over their hair coat, get longer, thicker, darker hair, and they'll, of course, lose their spots. Now, it's not universal. Every once in a while, there's a weird abnormality with a couple deer that have their spots through life, but that's an extreme unusual situation. Generally, losing the spots happens in September. We're already seeing deer that what you see in the fields now that are no longer reddish color, but you're seeing darker colored deer. They've already transitioned from that summer coat to the winter coat. The fawns, being smaller and less physiological mature, are going to go through that process a little bit later, that coat transition. So late September is generally when we see that transition. It's not uncommon to see some spotted fawns into October, but it's generally right about now.
Jim.
Okay, if they've still got spots, can you opine that they're younger than a certain age, like, say, you know, 10 weeks or 12 weeks?
Not necessarily. There's going to be some individual variation when they go through that coat transition, that transition, and so it may not necessarily be age dependent, but maybe more physiologically dependent, and so it could be nutrition influenced. But there's just going to be that individual variation. So I wouldn't make any presumptions about their age specifically by the presence of spots. Obviously, if we're talking about a spotted fawn in November and it looks like it's still only 25 pounds, then you can make some assumptions about its age. But at this time, they'll be going through that transition, some changing now, some changing next week, and so on.
Jim, thank you very much for the call. To Bern we go. And Heidi, you're on.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yep, we only have about a minute, so go ahead.
Hello?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay, we've had foxes in our yard. We live in Auburn in a property about 21 acres, and we've really enjoyed watching them. There's been three of them, two that stay together. And just this morning, we found one that was dead. It looked like it had been somehow mauled, but nothing took it away. And we do know we have coyotes around, but we're just wondering if you had any thoughts about what might have gotten one of our poor little foxes.
Well, you may have hit the nail on the head. So there is definitely some competition between coyotes and foxes, and the coyote may have caused the death of that fox. But that's not necessarily always the case. And so, of course, it's not uncommon for animals to be hit by vehicles and then stumble off the road to where they die a couple hundred yards away. That's a possibility as well. In any event, I would caution you not to handle that carcass. If you need to dispose of it, other than just letting it decompose on your property where it's dead, I would dig a hole and bury it using the shovel to handle it and then clean up from there. Don't handle it with your hands.
Heidi.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it here. All right. Here's the toughest one you guys are going to have, and we only have 10 seconds. This is from Helen. You ready? Coyote diet. How can I train my coyotes to eat the woodchucks?
Good luck.
Yeah, that's a good one.
All right. Well.
Woodchucks are not an easy meal.
No.
But some coyotes learn that on their own, yeah. And they key in on it, and they go for woodchucks.
Okay, fair enough.
We just got to hope that yours is one.
We'll send them over to Helen's house. Hey, both of you guys, thanks a lot for being here. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks, sure. Ray.
Support comes from Nathan LaTower Hospital, providing walk-in urgent care in Amsterdam, located just off the intersection of Route 30 and Golf Course Road, nlh.org. Berkshire Botanical Garden. The annual Harvest Festival returns October 8th at 9th, featuring activities for all, live music, kids' rides and games, vendors from throughout the region, berkshirebotanical.org. At West Africa Treasures, Crossgates Mall, featuring art, accent items, clothing, waste beads, African-sourced mineral stone jewelry, and more, handcrafted by African artisans, westafricatreasures.com. Once again, thanks to Jeremy Hurst and Carl Herzog for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Terrific calls today, and so many of them. We'll have to get to the next batch the next time these guys are on. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer, only partially domesticated. Thanks to Andrea Cunliffe for answering the phones today. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, I believe, Is it the gardening show tomorrow? Well, we'll find out tomorrow. I think it is gardening. Yeah, right, Zach? I don't really know anymore.